Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagra Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, our roundtable, but first joining us today are Michael Baer, the former chairman of the Defense Business Board and the president of the Dumbarton Strategies Consultancy, and Arnold Panaro, former staff director of the Senate Armed Services Committee, who's now chairman of the Panaro Group Consultancy and chairman of the National Defense Industrial Association. Both have played a key role in the defense side of presidential transitions over the past four decades. Gentlemen, welcome back to the program as always.
Great to be on, Bago.
Great to be back, Bago.
And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy. And Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Gentlemen, we've got a president of the United States, Joe Biden, number 46. Lloyd Austin has secured House and Senate waivers, obviously because he's a retired four-star Army general. Who retired 4 years ago, not 7 years ago, as required by law. Arnold, why don't you start us off? Where are we on his confirmation, right? We taped this early on Friday morning. We're expected by the end of the day for Lloyd Austin to become the nation's 28th defense secretary. But where are we on all the other key players, right? I mean, we've got Tony Blinken, Alex Mayorkas, Janet Yellen, right? I mean, each one of these are national security positions in their own right. Give us an update.
Well, Vago, the good news is, as of the afternoon of Friday, January 22nd, as you indicated, Lloyd Austin will go from being General Lloyd Austin to Secretary Lloyd Austin, as he will have achieved the necessary waiver signed into law by President Biden, also in the Senate only confirmation, and the president will sign the appointment papers, already has, and he will be sworn in and become the Secretary of Defense, the civilian leader, and the only other civilian in the chain of command from the president to the combatant commander. He joins, actually, a good cadre in place. As we know, the windup to the transition has been pretty messy, but now that we have the delivery, it's a fastball down the middle. The Department of Defense put in place in the department a series of actings or performing the duty of in all the key positions. They also onboarded at noon on January 20th, a sizable number of political appointees serving also in those same offices and key positions. So Lloyd Austin will get off to a very strong start. April Haynes' D&I is already confirmed. We expect Janet Yellen for Treasury, Blinken for State to be confirmed almost contemporaneously with Secretary Austin. The other national security nominees that have had confirmation hearings, Mayorkas to be DHS, should occur next week. Pete Buttigieg for transportation and others have had their hearings. So it appears that there's cooperation going on in the United States Senate on some of the key cabinet nominees. So we expect to have a good number of the really key ones in place here over the next week. Over.
Michael, yeah, your sense?
Arnold has it right, absolutely right in terms of the sequence. But I think it's important, as the committee noted, that Austin will take over sometime on Friday, today, over a Pentagon, which has had an extraordinary amount of instability at the top. Trump had five defense secretaries, five, two confirmed by the Senate and three others acting. The sole constant is Mark Milley, who's about 2.5 years through the first ever four-year term for the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which restricts Biden's ability to simply nominate a replacement for Milley, and I don't expect that he'll depart from Milley. But it's also important that this breaks yet another norm with yet another service pairing at the top, as we had with Mattis and Dunford, with nearly 100 years of Marine Corps experience and worldview. We now will have nearly 100 years of Army experience and worldview in the two top guys, the secretary and the chairman. It's a situation that was never imagined by the framers of the department in 1947. Over.
This is a good question to put to the both of you. You, Michael, as a retired U.S. Army Reserve colonel, and you, Arnold, as a retired United States Marine Corps Major General. You know, there was a lot of focus and debate about whether or not Lloyd Austin will be blurring the civil-military divide. So it's a two-part question for you guys. Did he answer that question? And right, because there's this sense that with the insurrection happening, the instability, let's just get this guy in for God's sakes. But also, what's the tone he needs to strike in there so that people don't see Lloyd Austin as part of an army mafia with Mark Milley, but Lloyd Austin, objective, completely purple Secretary of Defense sitting there in a both a nonpartisan and non-service specific manner. Michael, why don't you start us off and then Arnold.
So, Vago, I listened very carefully to General Austin's answers on civil control, and some of them were mildly unsettling to me. He said that he and the OSD would collaborate and coordinate with the Joint Staff. That's just simply not how the law works. And he also said his team would use the right, I'm quoting, the right language to be successful. And he said he would rebalance the workload between OSD and the Joint Staff. And that again suggests a lot of deference to the Joint Staff. None of these statements embody those particular statements embody the letter or the spirit of the law, and they don't presage for me a return to stronger civilian control. But I think most importantly, he didn't address civil control where the largest challenges exist, and that is at the services. Below the service secretaries, the civil control there is really hard to find after decades of service secretaries who previously had served in that service and often deferred to their subordinate flag officers and too often saw their job as protecting the services from OSD and from the Secretary of Defense. So I think, again, it's slightly unfair to judge the whole of the man, General Austin, from those comments that he made to the committee. And they were very anxious to proceed and get him confirmed. But nonetheless, words matter, and some of those really concern me. Over.
So, Arnold? So Vago, I would say that he certainly said the right things in his hearing, as Michael indicated. He also set the right tone, but actions are what count here. And there's some things that he's going to have to do far beyond what he said in his confirmation hearing to ensure we restore the balance and restore civilian control, which the National Defense Strategy Commission said has weakened. And frankly, most of the senators that spoke on both sides of the aisle acknowledged that, as did General Austin. He's going to have to make sure they bring in key, very strong civilian leaders at OSD in all the under positions and assistant secretary positions. And then these people have to be very strong because they're going to be going up against a very capable Joint Staff that's evolved over the last 30 plus years under Goldwater Nichols. He should really reduce the number of active duty military serving in the office of the Secretary of Defense. There are too many military people serving in key positions, non-confirmable positions at OSD. He should not bring in any more flag and general retired people into key positions, as was the norm in the previous administration. He should basically make sure that General Milley understands the Joint Staff is really the military staff of the Secretary of Defense, if you read Title 10 and Goldwater Nichols. And he should look very carefully at reducing the duplication between OSD and the Joint Staff, where the Joint Staff has maintained a lot of independence that really is the purview of OSD. So you can't just talk a good game, you have to do a good game. I'm confident that people understand that, but the Congress, quite frankly, is gonna have to provide a lot of oversight here to make sure the follow through is there. Over.
And there I see really good news. I think the build out of expertise and policy power that's being committed with the very strong, deep professionals like Kath Hicks as the Deputy Secretary, Kelly Magsum as Chief of Staff, and Colin Kahl as the Undersecretary for Policy. This is a significant internal shift of power and focus, and it puts teeth to what General Austin had promised to do to the committee. Over.
They're going to need a lot of teammates. Three people, as good as they are, I totally agree with Michael. Three people are not going to be able to take the full measure of 40 plus years of buildup on the Joint Staff.
Michael, really quickly, give us the sense, right? Arnold mentioned that an enormous number of Schedule C folks are going in acting as, but also some folks are going to be taking some of these jobs. There was an expectation by the Biden team that they wouldn't have the Senate. So it's important to get butts in seats to be able to at least be able to run the department, given that there were so many open jobs anyway. throughout the Trump administration. Is this potentially problematic, right? I mean, does this turn people off, or is this just a very logical approach to a complicated problem to make sure that you're managing one of the world's most complex organizations?
Well, Bago, the Department of Defense is a place of tradition and pattern. And so logic departing from that, while might have merit, is sometimes very difficult to actually execute. This is the reverse of the normal process. Normally, the principals are named then and confirmed, and then their staff arrives. That's not the case here. And it's going to require substantial leadership by the new secretary and the new deputy to enable that transition, not only of power and responsibility, but transition to a new management model, which is very different and promising, but in some ways a little bit challenging.
Arnold, let me get your take. Senate Majority Leader, Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell wants the 2-week delay to impeachment to allow President Trump's lawyers more time to prepare. We talked a little bit about the impeachment and how it could impede things. In about 2 weeks' time is when Joe Biden is going to be pushing a lot of legislation up there, and there are going to be a lot more confirmation hearings. Does this become something that fosters the disunity that Joe Biden wants to avoid?
Well, Vago, if we've talked many times, the Congress and the Senate can move as fast or slow as they want. They can get a lot done in 2 weeks. They can get a lot of people confirmed in 2 weeks. They could get the massive COVID package done in 2 weeks before they get to the impeachment if they don't get agreement in the Senate to double track it, where they can actually work confirmations and legislation in the morning and do the impeachment in the afternoon. So a lot can get done in this time frame, even with the looming specter of the impeachment trial starting in a couple of weeks. And it doesn't sound like they're going to be willing to dual track things during that period. Over.
Let me just very quickly ask you guys this question, and I want to ask for your thoughts in a moment about Dr. Jack London's passing, legendary chairman and CEO of CACI. But first, let me ask you very quickly a civil military and race relations question, because both of you were in a military that was very polarized in the Vietnam era by race riots. One of the important, there are two of the many jobs that Lloyd Austin will have to fulfill, is concerned by lawmakers and the American people of the number of former military people who are involved in the assault on the Capitol, which folks look at a particularly complicating civil-military relation issue. Then obviously there's the question of race in the ranks, where study after study has both shown some right-wing radicalization, even if people don't act on it in uniform, while also strong racial tensions. From your standpoint, as students of leadership and history, what are some of the things Lloyd Austin has to do to try to get this right? Because there is a lot of hope that he, as the first African-American Secretary of Defense, somebody who grew up in the Jim Crow South, will sort of understand intuitively the issues and drive change that maybe we haven't had in a long time, as well as to try to maybe de-radicalize people if they are that way. You know, give us briefly your sense from each of you, because I think this is an important question that you guys are ideally suited to address.
Well, Vago, I would say you need a strong signal and strong leadership from the top. I'm sure we'll get that from Secretary Austin. But this is a lot like the sexual assault issue, the suicide issue. It takes everybody at every level of the chain of command to root out these problems. You can't just put out a pronouncement and say, you know, we're going to change and not going to have any of this anymore. Everybody at every level, you know, from the lance corporal to the sergeant, the non-commissioned officers, the company commanders, battalion commanders, you've got to root this out at the grassroots level. And obviously you need strong leadership from the top. But that's the only way it's going to work, if the signal goes out. And frankly, if you have people that cross the line, either in uniform or when they're on their personal time, they need to face accountability. And we also need to basically distance ourselves from people that are out of uniform that are condoning these things. The military needs to treat them as pariahs, because that's what they are. Over.
Yes, I agree absolutely with Arnold. I mean, this has got to be fixed. It's not a training program. We've really got to get at it, hold people accountable. I think Lloyd Austin is the right guy to do that, but it's going to take time. And it's going to take some real strong actions to get this institution repaired. Over.
Arnold and Michael, Jack London, an absolute legend, powerhouse, who in many ways helped, as the NDIA press release said, shout out to Eva Marie Socha on your team, who did a terrific job on that, created the federal technologies business in many ways. He passed away this week at 83, and he was also a proud 1959 Naval Academy graduate, philanthropist, and leadership mentor. Arnold, very briefly, what's Jack London's legacy? And I know, Michael, you served on the CACI board and knew Dr. London well. You know, give us your sense. Arnold?
Well, Vago, Jack was not only a good friend and mentor, he was a colleague, as you said, an icon. He's the plank holder in creating the whole federal IT industry that we know today. A man of impeccable integrity, written several books on character and leadership, a warm person with his wife, Jennifer, a great supporter of the wounded troops and their family. I was with him on many occasions at those events. Just an all-around great person, great leader in our industry, great supporter of the troops and the family, and someone that will be sorely missed.
Vago, if I had to sum Jack up in one word, it would be patriot, a genuine patriot who cared deeply about the country and always placed that calculus first in the things that he did, believed, and felt. So he will be severely, sorely missed. I hope that generations that follow will take his life and patriotism as an example and a model to emulate.
Gentlemen, thanks so very much. Always a pleasure having you on. Look forward to having you back on. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Thank you, Vago.
And joining us now is our roundtable to discuss the week in Washington and beyond as America's COVID death toll surpasses 410,000 and another 1.4 million Americans file for unemployment. Joining us today are Dr. Gordon Adams, a fellow at the Quincy Institute and the Stimson Center, and a professor emeritus at American University, Byron Callen of the independent Washington research firm Capital Alpha Partners, Mackenzie Eaglin of the American Enterprise Institute, Michael Herson of American Defense International, one of Washington's top defense and aerospace lobbying firms, and former Pentagon comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who has many affiliations, including with the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Everybody, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Vago.
Glad to be back, Vago.
Always a pleasure.
Great to be back.
Thank you very much, Vago.
All right, everybody. We've got the 46th president of the United States in the Oval Office. Certainly a very, very powerful inaugural address calling for unity. Michael, start us off, right? How is this address and the president's new tone being seen up on the Hill? Obviously, we've got some lawmakers, Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, behaving as if nothing happened. Democrats, on the other hand, want the scalps of those who were involved that they view as trying to disenfranchise a legitimately elected president. Then there are issues about what's next with the filibuster, right? I mean, Mitch McConnell, the minority leader now, you know, being accused of sort of hamstringing the process, waiting for Chuck Schumer to say that, you know, the filibuster will be assured and a couple of other things, right? So what's, you know, first, I mean, how did you perceive the speech and how are lawmakers responding and what's the state of the debate? Because there is also a very soul-searching debate happening privately in the Republican Party at the end of the day. Give us sort of the temperature of where we are now.
Okay, great. Well, I think you're spot on. There is a lot of soul-searching. I've talked to several members of Congress over the last couple of days on both sides of the aisle and had some really great conversations actually with some members of the Republican leadership. But, you know, look, I think Biden's speech was really fantastic. I think really the whole day was good. The whole day of messaging. I think even my wife said maybe we should get rid of the inaugural balls and just do this instead, because I think they really put on a good show and delivered a strong, unifying message. And, you know, look, I think McConnell was very good after the inauguration. He sent out congratulatory tweets to the president and vice president, lauded the peaceful transfer of power. Even McCarthy spoke to his conference and told everybody that they need to watch their tone and why it's important. But this was after he got a briefing from the FBI. You know, however, as you pointed out, I mean, the haters are going to hate, right? So, you know, Ted Cruz sent out a crazy tweet after Biden signed several executive orders saying that by rejoining the Paris Climate Agreement, President Biden indicates he's more interested in the views of the citizens of Paris than the jobs of citizens of Pittsburgh. So I hope Ted Cruz doesn't think that the treaty is with the citizens of Paris. It's actually just was actually signed in Paris. But
you're sounding a little like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who reminded them, right? The Geneva Convention is not about Geneva, right?
Exactly. Well, she's right about that. And, you know, as you mentioned, too, I mean, Senator Hawley has also stepped up to block the quick confirmation of the DHS secretary. As I mentioned last week, Marjorie Greene did introduce articles of impeachment against Biden yesterday. So, you know, look, there's still a lot of challenges that lie ahead. I mean, this is not going away anytime soon. The Senate Ethics Committee, now there are seven Democrats that filed the complaint against Cruz and Hawley. They want an investigation, possible vote on expulsion. The impeachment trial is going to keep this on the front pages, especially if there is a delay. And I think there probably will be a delay because I think people want to show that the process is fair to give Trump a chance to prepare a defense. It also gives Republicans a chance to try and argue why it should be dismissed, whether there is the constitutional authority for the Senate to convene an impeachment trial against a president who's no longer in office. But I think they probably do have the authority to do it. And then there's going to be a commission on what happened on January 6th, which will also keep tensions running high. And frankly, I think even by delaying the impeachment trial, more and more evidence, more and more video will come out about what happened, which will keep tensions and pressures high. And at the same time in the House, Liz Cheney continues to fight for her political life. She now has a primary challenger. She was censured by the Wyoming Republican Party. And there's a challenge now afoot to strip her leadership position, although it's going to be hard because it will require two-thirds of the Republican Congress to get such a vote. But Congresswoman Lee Stefanik and Congressman Zeldin are making calls to try and see if they can get people's support to take out Cheney and replace him with one of them. And I think the larger problem that the Republicans have and the country has is really the messaging that's going to continue to come out from Fox, from Newsmax, and from channels like OAN. You know, one of the things I like to do when there's something going on in the world is not only watch CNN, but flip over and see what those channels are covering. And if you watch during the inauguration, those channels are covering Crazy Town. OAN had a whole section on the reason that there are troops up around the Capitol during the inauguration is because the election was stolen. And that's why they need the troops there. If the election wasn't stolen, they wouldn't need the troops in the first place. And that's a real problem when you've got almost half of America watching those channels and they're going to continue to believe things that aren't necessarily true.
I do think it's rather impressive the lengths to which some members are going to change track, right? I mean, we saw Kevin McCarthy, in fact, make a complete U-turn, saying, "I never blamed the president," which is exactly the speech that he made, on the House floor. In fact, right? I mean, so that's a concern, I think, that folks have. Byron, and I want to go down the line and get everybody's take on it. And Byron, let me start with you. I mean, in part from your historical view, but also what you think some issues and challenges are going forward that you either think haven't gotten as much attention or you think we should be paying attention to.
Well, I think the first is going to be, great. This inauguration may be the high point, but I think now we're kind of back into the nitty gritty slog fest. I had an exchange with Gordon and I'm curious if he can weigh in this again, but reconciliation and how that might be used by the Biden administration, particularly as it pertains to discretionary spending, because part of that may center on the COVID-19 relief package, but then, stacked up right behind that is going to be the recovery package. So I think we're, Michael touched on some of these issues, but I think this kind of, how did the Biden agenda really move forward, not just around filibuster and that whole debate, but reconciliation, how that can be used, I think is going to be critical. And then we can dive into this a little bit further, but I think the geopolitical backdrop is really intriguing too. I was curious, how frequently China was mentioned during Lloyd Austin's hearing, but I don't think Iraq came up once. We had a suicide bombing there on Thursday that was kind of unique because ISIS was involved. And, there are other issues involving Russia, for example, that have come up with Navalny's return to that country. So there are a lot of pots on the stove. And, maybe we stepped out of the kitchen during Inauguration Day, but it's sure going to be hot when we get back in there.
And then obviously, right, we have an added dynamic of the domestic pressures that are going to be playing. And I do want to get folks' sense on that. Well, let me lay the issue on the table for anybody who wants to address it, right? I mean, there is a concern how the unfortunate involvement of active guard reserve veteran retirees in the planned insurrection that, well, I mean, was an attempted coup, in fact, that attacked the Congress in order to stop the constitutional certification of the new president. The number of military people, right? NPR is reporting that one out of five arrested were former military, you know, and at the end of the day, there's military veterans who are in Congress are asking, hey, look, what's going on here? Obviously, a lot of concerns about white supremacy in the military, racism that exists in the military, and how that kind of might be playing into the broader debate, you know, as we try to sort of get to national unity, because effectively now you've got highly trained and very dangerous people who may be belonging to these militia groups, whether Oath Keepers or Three Percenters or you know, QAnon supporters and what have you. Mackenzie, let me get your sense on where we are and where we're going, and then hear from Gordon and then Dove. And Dove, I should point out, you've got a piece in The Hill that came out this morning as well. Go ahead, Mackenzie.
Well, I thought the Senate hearing for Lloyd Austin to become Secretary of Defense this week, you know, the most powerful moment to emerge from it was his own personal experience as a Lieutenant Colonel in the 82nd Airborne, where the unit discovered too late, well, not too late, but the unit discovered belatedly that there were white supremacists in the ranks. And then, you know, they learned from it. The people were punished accordingly. And he talked about how the signs were there all along. So he does seem uniquely qualified to help lead on this issue. He spoke with passion and commitment and saying, you know, we can never basically take our foot off the gas on this issue. And he's right. The challenge for him is, I don't know that he knows how much is about to come at him. It's, you know, as we all know, it's a fire hose job. And if you don't stay true to your big three agenda items, whatever they are, everything else will consume you.
Michael, and it looks like there's some breaking news about Lloyd Austin.
Yes, he was approved overwhelmingly by the U.S. Senate just now, 93-2. And it's interesting, only two senators voted against him. So, but I was interested to see that Josh Hawley was one of the two senators to vote against him. So he seems to be doubling down on being the, you know, the pain in the ass going forward.
And who was the other one?
The other one was Senator Mike Lee from Utah, who's also a Republican.
Absolutely fascinating. So this is an enormous bipartisan, you know, vote of confidence, obviously, in Lloyd Austin, which, right, folks were looking at, I think even we discussed on the program, that it was looking like it was going to be, you know, potentially a tight vote, a Hagel-like vote. I'd be remiss if I didn't quickly ask you, President Biden's got his $1.9 trillion package out. He just said we need a wartime strategy, right? Looking at surging vaccine production with the Defense Production Act, as well as the masks on federal property, social distancing, no large gatherings, and the enforcement of that, right? Airlines are even responding now. Where do we stand very briefly on all of these issues, given that earlier in the week, Republicans still were not wearing masks in the Senate?
Well, look, we saw how long it took to get the last coronavirus relief package done. It took over 8 months. So I know Biden wants to get one done quickly, and he's right to want to get one done quickly. So the question is, will they coalesce around the things that they can all agree on and get a smaller package done quickly, like the increased payment to individuals, the money for vaccine distribution, et cetera? However, the problem with that is if you only do the popular things now, it makes it harder to do the other things later that the Democrats really want to do and get done. So this negotiation is going to go on for quite some time. And the other option they have is to wait to stick a lot of this into what's called the budget reconciliation package that we talked about last week, which would not require them to get 60 votes in the Senate. But if all the Democrats stuck together and Kamala Harris passed the tiebreaker, they'd be able to pass that, it that way. So it still remains to be seen. Talks are going on, but I am confident that relief will be passed in the first quarter of this year.
Yeah, Gordon, I know that we got a little bit distracted, so you can take this in any direction you want to go. I just want to get everybody's sense on these points as we try to work with them on what is sort of a more philosophical week as opposed to sort of a lot of concrete specifics that we want to try to tackle.
Well, let me first come back to where we started, which is the question of the president's inaugural address and where he's kind of headed and whether he's framed the issues appropriately. I mean, I really heard it as an address that emphasized hope rather than fear. And a lot of what he has done is to try to build in the expectation that things that have gone very bad may start to go very well. He outlined the racism and white supremacy issue. He outlined economic issues, the pandemic issues, and the restoration of American democracy. And I think that's probably the right agenda. I wasn't looking for a State of the Union speech where he ticked every issue and talked about every country in the world. There was very little there on foreign threats, but a great deal on the real threats. Climate change, rejoining the Paris Accord, Russia, investigations by the intelligence community on things like hacking and this poisoning of Navalny and bounties on troops and interference in the elections. The agenda, Russia, more Russia, New Start extended for 5 years, foreign policy move, right? But the major focus of his attention in the speech and in the executive orders and the things he's done since have all been on tackling those four major crises that he underlined. And I took that as extremely positive and a step towards at least advancing his hope to restore some kind of unity in the country. And my suspicion, and what Michael was saying tends to reinforce it, is that there's enough people who voted Republican or voted for Trump who are looking for some kind of an opportunity to restore the system, that there may be some prospect of that. There is a rank opportunism going on and messaging argument coming from some quarters of the Republican Party, the fake call for unity, and by doing an impeachment trial, you were destroying American unity from the very people who destroyed American unity. I mean, that strikes me as hypocrisy of the first order. But he's basically identified the right set of concerns and has begun to do it in a very professional manner. What I found most striking, this is not a piece of reading I would normally do, is I read every page of the 21-page single-spaced document on the pandemic and his response to COVID. And it was a pleasure to read it because it was so sensible. It was so focused. It touched the right bases. The challenge always will be in the implementation. But it wasn't a document riddled with attacks on enemies and, criticism of others and they screwed up and the Democrats are to blame or the Republicans are to blame. It was about how do we move forward on what is the single most important challenge facing us right now, this minute, the 407,000 Americans who have died in the pandemic. So he's got, I think, the right packaging so far for what the real threats are to America, what the real challenges we have to deal with. I would have been shocked to the teeth if he had done a speech that focused on Russia and China. That would be amazingly off tune. And instead he focused on exactly the issues, and they're all gonna be challenges that we have to deal with. So I was impressed with the speech and I was impressed with the way that he started out and he's focused on the real challenges that we face.
I would say, though, that, and I'm going to give our producer, Chris Cervello, credit for this, right? He had 15 strikeouts and a no-hitter in game one. There are still 161 games to go in the season. See, Dove, I can cue up a good baseball reference for you to pick up on.
Well, that's fine. And you're absolutely right. I don't know if he struck out 15. He walked a few people. And the reason I say that is it was an honest speech. He's not a good speaker. He's not a Kennedy. He's not an Obama. But you knew he meant every word. And I think that was critically important, that he meant every word he said, and it came across that he meant every word he said. The real challenge for him is this. He's done all the right things in the first few days with all those executive orders. But in order to make this really a turning of the corner, there's got to be legislation. He is reversing Trump's orders, who reversed Obama's orders, who couldn't do very much with Congress. That has got to change, or else we're going to be in some kind of ping pong, political ping pong ball for a long time, and this country just can't take that anymore. A couple of other things. I do have a piece this morning in The Hill on white supremacy in the military. I'm absolutely convinced that we're not going to win wars if we're fighting with each other. 40%+ of the military are people of color, minorities of all kinds, and you cannot have unit cohesion if you've got white supremacy. And without unit cohesion, I don't care what kind of weapons you've got, makes no difference. You're not going to win. And so this is a national security problem of the first order. Whether Austin can deal with that or not, we talked about this a couple of seconds ago, I don't know. Partly because of what McKenzie said, he'll have a lot on his plate, but partly also because there really has to be some concrete work done. Now, interestingly, his predecessor, Miller, one of the things he did do was to get them to relook at the Unified Code of Military Justice. That's one way to start, but it's only a start. And frankly, this isn't just a national security issue in its narrow sense. It's a domestic issue. That's what January 6th was all about. One other quick thought. One of the wonderful things about the inauguration was the dog that didn't bark. There was no trouble. There were no obvious riots. Everything went smoothly. And that really gave me, and I think a lot of people, and I got a lot of emails from all over the world, friends of mine in and out of government. It gave us all a lot of hope.
Still feel very, very bad that Joe Biden was not, after a lifetime of pursuing the office and preparing for this moment, was not able to get the inauguration that he deserved with, you know, crowds welcoming the new president, a tremendous fireworks display that was seen by very, very few people. Although, as Michael noted, it was a lot of people did enjoy it on TV and perhaps might be a model going forward. I would also submit, I've arrived at the same conclusion in a piece that's on our website as well, that this is an existential threat to the Republic, and the United States can't lead abroad if it's divided at home. Effectively and riven by disinformation, which is indeed the single deadliest weapon, as we've been discussing on this program for a very, very long time. I want to ask you guys, does the military involvement piece of it, the questions about racism, the question of white supremacy, end up something that undermines or weakens civil military discord? Because it sounds like folks are very, very worried about this. And As you said, Gordon, right? People that even Austin, right? He said we should have known, we knew, we sensed it, and yet we somehow didn't address it. And that seems to be sort of a common theme. I mean, is this something? Well, let me go to you, Michael. I mean, is this something that you think is on lawmakers' minds? And if so, is this something that's going to end up getting aired more and more and more, especially when we see the results of this investigation that are being led by a very well-respected retired United States Army Lieutenant General, who's also an African-American, General Honore.
Yeah, look, I think you're right. I think it is on lawmakers' minds. I don't think it's very high up there yet. I think people are waiting to see what the investigation, you know, concludes. But, you know, I think that we've got to take a step back here and say, look, you know, the military has dealt with discord in its ranks, you know, for forever. You know, most recently, we saw it back at the beginning of the all-volunteer force, where we had a lot of racial divisions in the military. And, you know, the Reagan administration, I think, invested a tremendous amount of money in improving the quality of force and addressing some of those concerns. But also, you know, the military now, active duty, is 1.4 million people. So even though it's not a clear representation of America, you're going to have a little bit of everything. You're going to have people who commit crimes. You know, we're going to have people who are white supremacists. You know, you're going to have a little bit of everything there. So I don't think it's as alarming as people make it seem. As long as the military can deal with this forcefully and directly, I'm not that concerned that this is a major issue, that we're going to have an insurrection in this country led by white supremacists in the military. The military is always going to have personnel problems. I used to work in this area in the Pentagon. It's the worst, you know, to me, it's the worst office in the Pentagon. It's the committee on Capitol Hill that no one wants to serve on. No one wants to be on the personnel subcommittee because these are the toughest issues to deal with. But I don't think it's as serious a problem as it's being made out to be.
Byron, what's your sense on, right? I mean, if you were them, what would you be focused on? And Mackenzie, want to get your sense on that as well in terms of.
I agree, you know, with both what Michael and Dove pointed out. You know, I think it is a problem. I don't think it's an existential problem for the United States. It's something that, you know, I am curious kind of the reaction to a lot of these groups after January 6th, and then, of course, Inauguration Day. I mean, I think you've got a lot of people who are going to sit back and kind of regroup, you know, the cutting off of some of these social media channels to communicate, I think it's also going to be important. But, you know, you also have to remember that some of these extremist groups look at January 6th as a recruiting opportunity. So it's clearly going to be something that the country's going to have to pay attention to. I don't think it's going to be solved just by a lot of non-defense discretionary spending. This isn't something that's coming up from the lowest rungs of society from an economic standpoint, although you could argue that some of the destabilizers that contributed people joining these groups emanated from things like the 2008-2009 financial crisis. So it probably really demands a closer kind of national look. It's not just the military that's going to be involved in this. It's clearly law enforcement, as was pointed out as well, too. So I just think, you know, and a lot of this comes just down to simple disinformation, as Michael pointed. I mean, some of these news outlets are frankly delusional, and I don't know how you curtail that or cut it back, but it's at the very least worthy of a very strong national conversation on it. And I absolutely hope that this is something that comes about in 2021.
Sorry about that. And I should point out, right, Jake Sullivan, the new president's national security advisor, has talked about getting to these economic grievances, right? How do we get greater equity in society? You know, how do we get government working for people as opposed to becoming the target of attack? Mackenzie, want to go to you. And then Gordon, I know you've been very patient as we've sort of gone around the horn. Go ahead, Mackenzie.
So to your question, I see this much more as a readiness issue as opposed to a civil military relations problem. And this, the data just bears this out across the major challenges confronting the armed forces. The two, you know, sort of big ones that came up again in Mr. Austin's hearing: extremism in the ranks and sexual assault and sexual violence. Members are very much worried about this. I have not heard that much emphasis on sexual assault and violence in a long time by the committee, but a lot of this, of course, is driven by the events at Fort Hood and other places. Right. Senator Hirono talked about a member of the military who was murdered and found in the garbage trash bin just a week ago. So it's a problem. It's a problem everywhere. It's a problem across the services. And these are two huge personnel challenges that can cause readiness challenges. And as Dove said, doesn't matter what weapons you have. If you have these kinds of problems and people are afraid of each other, you know, serving in their same units or at odds with each other, you know, we're going to lose everything. We're going to lose all the wars and all the battles and everything in between. So it's a huge readiness problem. And there is data that backs that up. And it's something that, you know, I think that's the reason that General Austin will have to care about it, not just because it's the right thing to do, but he's going to have real challenges if he needs to, you know, use the force in any meaningful way.
Gordon, go ahead.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of comments that I'd like to make on this. One, I think everybody who's talked so far is absolutely correct in saying this issue has not gone away. Anybody who thinks the successful meeting at the end of the 6th of January that certified the President of the United States and the vote simply did away with the issue is smoking something, because it is the underlying dimension has not gone away. The media has not gone away. The issue in the police forces at the local and state levels has not gone away. Broader Republican efforts to suppress the vote have not gone away. Alec and the supporters of legislation that would suppress the vote in numerous states that Republicans control have not gone away. The whole thing is not dead. There's a very, very long struggle, and poor Joe Biden's going to have to deal with it for the next 4 years. The other thing I want to say is, and I think this is an issue in civil-military relations, it's kind of subtle, but I read the transcript of General Austin's hearing, and as you know, I wrote something that basically said I was concerned about the civil-military issue in providing the waiver, which is now done, and it'll probably be confirmed on Friday. But the reality here is that there is a civil military issue, and it's the capacity of somebody whose basic loyalty and identity has been to uniforms in being tough with the uniforms. That's the challenge. And when I read in the hearings that General Austin was going to be working with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and that he was going to ensure proper civil control over the military by appointing the right people in the right places, it gave me pause. One of the secretaries of defense for whom I have great admiration as Secretary of Defense was Dick Cheney. And Dick Cheney came into office in 1989. He basically knew that the way one, as a civilian, the way one has to deal with the military on some very critical issues is to be very disciplined and very clear and very tough, determined. And they have to be able to not to, to work with the Joint Chiefs. The secretary has to send a message that he is in charge and that civilian control is in charge. And you have to be prepared to tell the chiefs, which Cheney did, no, you can't have that. No, you can't run around me to the hill. No, you can't build that airplane. You run around, I'm going to fire you. That's a civilian action, right? And General Austin, for all of his merit as a serving officer, and he's got a lot, is going to be challenged immediately or sweet-talked by the service chiefs in the internal politics of the Pentagon. We all know this. Everybody on this show knows that this is part of the politics of the Pentagon. So I am concerned that General Austin needs to step out very smartly and in a very disciplined and firm way on this issue that everybody rightly says it's a problem of readiness, it's a problem of order, it's a problem of politics, it's a problem of cohesion. And I think it's one of the first problems that he has on his desk, and I'm hoping he steps out smartly and firmly on it.
We're all going to have to also adapt to not calling him General Austin, but Secretary Austin, which took a little bit of doing even with Secretary Mattis. Dove, why don't you wrap us up here today on this free form edition of the roundtable?
Well, quickly to pick up on what Gordon just said, it wasn't just being tough. What Dick Cheney did was fire Mike Dugan, the chief of staff of the Air Force, because he didn't like what he said. And he did it very quickly, and that sent the message to the people in uniform. And so the question is, you know, when retired people still speak to somebody who's a superior to them in retirement, they still call them sir. And what will General Austin do? Will he say to a chief of staff, you're fired, sir? But that is a key question. Would he be able to look a chief of staff in the eye and say, you're fired? None of the chiefs of staff merit that, but that's the fundamental issue. Can he do something like that? I just want to add one other thing about the white supremacy in the military. The military is often the first place where we make social change. That's what Truman did in 1948. He desegregated the military, and that was the first step on a very, very long road that we still haven't completed in terms of racial equality. Dealing with white supremacy in the military will inevitably lead to dealing with white supremacy among the police and other institutions. It's got to be started there, and it has to be started there very, very quickly. And if Secretary Austin has too many other things on his plate, then it falls to Kath Hicks, the deputy, who could be very, very powerful and certainly determined to bring about equality in the military. Because as I said before, and I'll say it again, if we want to win wars, we've got to do something about this. We didn't talk much about Iraq, as Byron mentioned it in passing, but there's a real issue here. Because when we pulled out of Lebanon in 83, we basically forgot about Lebanon. And the word buzzing around the Middle East right now, including an article by a leading journalist who's based in Dubai, is we're pretty much doing the same thing with Iraq. We're not talking about it. We're trying to forget about it. And in the meantime, Iran is stepping up its pressure on the Iraqis, and that would be a tremendous disaster for everything we've been trying to do and having kids die for the last 20 years.
And I would say the same thing in Afghanistan, right? We're taking our eye off the ball there as well in our zeal to get out. And every adversary in the world is looking at that as well, right? I mean, the unfortunate thing about the degree of domestic discord is January 6th was just an absolute gift to China, Russia, to North Korea, Iran, and any other authoritarian regime that wants to point to the United States and go, see how broken they are? That's the world's number one democracy. You want more of that? It's just absolutely heartbreaking. And Michael, just very, very quickly, Senate obviously changed hands. Chuck Schumer of New York, the New York Democrat, becomes the first Jewish American to lead any either one of the bodies. A very, very proud moment for a son of Brooklyn and for greater representation in the United States. But where are we on key committee assignments? Right, Jack Reed, expected to be the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee. Who else is in contention, especially about defense appropriations, which we've been talking about for a while?
All right. So we touched a little bit on this last week. Senator Jack Reed will lead the Senate Armed Services Committee. Some of the subcommittees, there could be some change. We do expect change, as I mentioned last week, on the Sea Power Subcommittee. Very possible that Senator Blumenthal takes over that subcommittee. But on appropriations, We were wondering last week who would take over the subcommittee on defense. And I mentioned they're going to have to go deep down because of the changes in the rules as to who can chair subcommittees and full committees. And as of yesterday, it was believed that Senator Schatz from Hawaii would be the new chair of the defense subcommittee. He is the 8th ranking person on the subcommittee, but now he will be number one and be the chair. And Leahy, of course, will take over as chair of the full committee. And then the question on Leahy is, since he's up for re-election 2 years, is he going to be running again or not? And will we be subject to another change in just 2 years?
Everybody, thanks very, very much for joining us. We appreciate it. Have a great weekend and looking forward to having you all back on next week.
Thanks, Roger. Thank you.
Thanks.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.